about that time, so we'll start in. For the benefit of the tape, I say this is Granger Westberg, and I'm talking about taking a spiritual history. This, as I indicated last night, came about because doctors were saying to us, do you ministers take a spiritual history when you're dealing with people? And our reply was, no, not really. But we do talk to them at length, and perhaps after we've been with them for an hour or so or two, we'd be able to give you a fair picture of a spiritual history. But then we began thinking about it and realizing that, as they were saying, why don't you just be up front with it and tell them that you're really concerned about the spiritual aspects of their problem, and maybe it would save you some time, because we were indicating to doctors that often patients kind of skirt around the problems, they go in all directions, and we as ministers try not to be dogmatic or try not to be like school teachers would have to be for an exam at the end of the hour, and so on. And we're taught, or we've developed this over the years, of a pastoral counseling method that does not intrude on people's privacy, that says, tell me more. And you can tell the pastor anything you want, but you don't have to tell him anything you don't want. So we're kind of caught between the dilemma of being too relaxed, too unstructured, and the other extreme, which would be too structured. Now, some of you know about Carl Rogers. How many of you have heard that name? Half of you. Good. Carl Rogers was at the University of Chicago when I first came. He had just come there in 1952. And Seward Hiltner, who I worked closely with in the Divinity School, was a good friend of Carl's. And so he said, would you be willing, Carl, to teach a class of theological students? Well, no, he said, I've tried to keep away from religion ever since I left the seminary. Carl Rogers had started out to be a minister and went to Union Seminary in New York and was so turned off by the dogmatism of professors and of religion in general that he wanted no more to do with it. So he got his PhD in clinical in psychology finally at Ohio State, left the seminary, and tried to keep away from religion the rest of his life. But the strange thing is that he was unable to keep away from it because we tended to move toward him, because this fellow was in so many ways so Christ-like and so understanding of people and so loving and caring and so opposed to the contemporary psychological approach, which was pretty cutting and devastating to some people, and certainly certain types of Freudian counseling were devastating. He said, but if your theological students want to come to my classes in the Department of Psychology, that's okay. So I remember going in and sitting in on one of his classes right from the start when I went on the staff there, and he took a conversation that he had recorded of himself and a person that was in trouble in his counseling center, which developed under his tutelage. And he took out all the parts of his response, just eliminated them, and read to us from and the class was a huge one, from 200 students, I'm sure, were in that class, as he was a very popular lecturer. And he said, now I'm going to read you what this person said to me, and then I want you to write down what you would have said if you had been in my place. So we did, and then he'd read the next line of what the person said without telling you what he said. And you get the next line of what the person said, and you'd have to write down what you would respond there, and so on. It was a fascinating thing to see how the responses of all of us in those days were preaching. Now, in the class were a lot of psychologists, psychology students, too. and many people who weren't religious. But we all came out at about the same place. We were trying to tell this person that they ought to shape up, you know, and we were trying to do it nicely, but that's what we were doing. And we weren't really listening to what this person had to say. And it was really an upsetting thing for the whole of the ministry of America to have this man, Carl Rogers, come in and tell us that we should have non-directive counseling. Well, he's gone through the years. He's still living down here in California at La Jolla. He's about 82 now, and still writing, and still people coming to him, and a remarkable guy. So we are indebted as ministers for changing our preachy approach to Carl Rogers to developing a non-directive approach, which now, since then, he has changed quite a bit, and it's now called a client-centered approach. And he's been moving, in a sense, back somewhat to a combination of being able to state your own point of view and at the same time listening deeply to what the person is saying. So I use that as kind of an introduction to tell you that we as ministers resist the idea of taking a spiritual history. But nevertheless, we decided we would attempt to do it. So let me show you something that we have been working on, and these are changes that are going on and so on, so that this is not the finished product. And we've tried it in some ways, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. We give the patient who comes into the doctor's office this two-page statement. And it's all mixed up because I've been Xeroxing it one way or another. At the top of the page, we mean to have this little statement from the doctors in that clinic. The doctors say, good health needs to deal with the whole person, body, mind, and spirit. Sometimes we are so concerned about people's physical and mental condition, we tend to neglect matters of the human spirit. All questions are optional. We think our patients should know by these questions that, as physicians, we consider a person's spiritual life to be very important in both diagnosis and treatment. Now, how do you feel about that statement? Are you comfortable with it? If you got it, if you walked into a doctor's office and he handed you this and then that was the statement at the top, how would you feel about it? Yes?
I think spiritual is a bit vague. It seems to me we need to go into the emotional side of it. Probably people understand better than spiritual.
All right. What is your reflection on that comment? Remember, this pastoral counselor in this doctor's office, this holistic health center, is trying very hard not to look like a psychologist.
To me, the word emotion is more frightening than spiritual.
All right.
If someone wants to examine my emotions, I would
kind of back up.
I think I'd like that.
And you feel a little more comfortable with the word spiritual.
Yeah.
Surprised, perhaps, going into a doctor's office that he wants to know about that. But you don't want a psychiatrist coming at you with the emotional problem, okay?
Yeah, I think the other thing is that if you want to get honest responses, you have to make it as non-threatening as possible. And to allow them, when you're sharing spiritual feelings, you're really sharing something very, very personal in terms of your own particular history. There's a wide range in terms of, so if you make it too specific, I think you may lead people in a way instead of just letting them respond and figure out where they're trying to go.
Okay, yes?
I think the more I let my doctor know about me, the whole me, the better he can treat me, and that's what I'm after.
All right, so you'd feel good. This would be a holistic approach to you. I'm wondering about the words. I'm thinking of your comment about spiritual being vague. What about the philosophy, the words, or just as physicians, we consider a person's, let's say, outlook on life, using the phrase we've been using the last few days, outlook on life to be very important in both diagnosis and treatment. Would that be?
I'd like that better.
You'd like that better? You know, I've never thought of it until now.
I realize it includes outlook on life and all that.
Okay, outlook on life might just be a little less threatening even yet. We had a suggestion here. We wrote down that one doctor said, "No, I don't like that. I'd have it like this." We recognize that this is a very very personal information, and we would be pleased if you would be willing to share it with us. However, if you feel uncomfortable with any questions, you need feel no concern about not completing the questionnaire. See, he's really concerned. Oh, he says, "I don't think I can say this to my patients." And so he wants to fudge a little more. Well, here we go. The first question, I better face this way, is how would you describe how important religious faith is to you? And then you have the, just check, we try to make this as simple as possible so you don't have to write anything. Very important, fairly important, not important at all. Question again is, how would you describe how important religious faith is to you? How do you feel about that question? Okay? Wouldn't upset you if you were a non-religious person even?
Well, I'd be pleased if the doctor wanted to know more than just about my body.
Okay. This is not threatening? See, we're trying to start on a very low level. Just saying, how would you describe how important religious faith is to you? And they can say, very important, not important, somewhat important, not important at all.
I don't think it's so threatening probably to the group we have here.
Yeah,
think about the people that go to the doctor, other than
that's what I wondered
that aren't part of a group like this. I think that's
right.
A different thing, too.
That's right.
But they can put not important at all.
They
can,
maybe they don't want you
but they probably
that either. That's they
say, they say gee, this doctor... Just say, fairly important. So you see the patient saying to himself, gee, this doctor is interested in religion or something. I don't want to hurt his feelings. I better not put not important at all or he'll come at me. See how touchy all this stuff is if you come out front and just say, let's get going. We want to know where you stand. If we want to get moving fast. See, the doctor keeps saying, you guys in religion, you take too long. We don't have time for that. We've only got 8 minutes in this minute, to see this patient. We've got to get going. And we say to them, that's why you're not doing a very good job, because you spend only 8 minutes with a patient. Yes?
On the other hand, if people are coming to the holistic center, aren't they looking for something different?
That's right. So we are in a better position. But I should tell you that I presented this to several groups of doctors who do not have holistic centers, and that's why they're feeling very uncomfortable. Oh, boy, I don't think I could do this. And I said, but you guys want us to be more direct. Well, then why don't you do that when you visit with a patient? You know, that's fine. But I'm not sure I want to do it in my office, because I don't want to be known as a kooky kind of doctor. Okay, the second question is, has your religious faith been helpful to you when you are going through difficult times? Frequently, occasionally, never. Threatening? Has it been helpful to you? Frequently, it has. Occasionally it has. It's never been important. Except for the question, do I have to please this doctor by saying nice things about religion to him? 3, how do you presently feel about your own religious faith or your own philosophy of life? Feel good about it. Mostly feel good about it. Not pleased with it. Never think about it. Other.
The question again is,
how do you presently feel about your own religious faith or your own philosophy of life? Feel good about it. Mostly feel good about it. Not pleased with it. Never think about it. Other. Yes.
How do you feel about a person, let's say he's a heavy drinker, an alcoholic? In answer to those questions, say he wants to put up a big front here. You know, he's not going to be honest with himself. That's what I'm trying to say.
Uh-huh.
So I can see that part coming through.
That's right.
You know, he's going to answer all of those to the best of, you know, he's a perfect person. But it isn't going to give you much you're going to uncover that.
This won't do it, because he's going to give you a different answer. He's going to, he's been lying for years.
Yeah.
He's an excellent liar. All right, four. How helpful can a person's faith or philosophy of life be in keeping one well? How helpful can a person's faith or philosophy of life be in keeping one well? Very helpful. Can be helpful. Depends on quality of person's faith or philosophy. Not at all helpful. Other. Would you feel, well, let's just take this group because we can't constantly think about other people who are not interested in spiritual things. How would you feel about that question? Would you be comfortable with it? You wouldn't have, you probably mostly would say can be helpful or very helpful. Or depends on the quality of a person's faith. Five, do you think that a person's type of religious belief or philosophy can make one sick? Yes, no. If yes, please comment on your reply. Now, why do you think we added that one? Why? Do you think that a person's type of religious belief can make one sick? Why would we have added that?
Does it have to do with the concept of sin?
Would it have to do with the concept of sin?
Guilt.
Yeah. Guilt?
Legalism. Oppressiveness.
What?
Oppression. Some religions have kind of an oppressive nature to them.
See, what we're thinking is that coming into the doctor's office are people who have no use for religion, and all they know are fanatics. And they know that some of them do some foolish things, including not taking care of their children when they're sick because they just pray. We thought that we needed a question like this to make that kind of person feel, hey, yeah, I think that a person's type, some types of religion do make people sick. Let him say something positive for a change. Yes, he can answer. And let him know that we're open to that kind of discussion. Six. I'm not going to use this one because I'm going to use this in a different connection. Seven. What people in your life had most to do with forming your present religious or philosophical position? Mother, what people? They can check any of or all of these. Mother, father, other family member, clergy, teachers, friends, spouse, others. And this is just to kind of loosen them up a bit to tell us something about their friends, who has influenced their lives. Eight. Are you now related to some religious organization? Now, when we have talked to doctors about this over the years, and we say, would you ever feel that you ought to ask any questions about their religious faith? Oh, no, no. Well, yeah, we always, you know, it's all right in the hospital, it says, what's your religious affiliation? Do you feel that's adequate? Oh, yeah, that's plenty. Just, you know, just to know if they're Protestant or Catholic. And, of course, we as ministers think that's as good as almost nothing. It's okay, you know, it helps us to know something about them. But to call that a question of having to do with their spiritual life is just kind of laughable. And that's about all that the average doctor feels we have any right to ask. In fact, in some hospitals, as you know, they refuse to ask that question. And the next question that we'd like them to ask, what church do you belong to? Even church hospitals are finding that they really don't want to ask that. And right now, we're working on our computer at Lutheran General, which doesn't ask that question, because we have so many who say they're Methodist or Baptist and so on. We can't find out beyond that unless we go to the room and talk to them. So we're hoping in the new computer that we'll at least ask them the name of your church and location so that we get some feel for it. Because this way we can't even call their church and tell them that they're in the hospital. Number nine. In other words, we're finally getting down to the basic question. At number eight, Are you related to some religious organization? See, we're not saying, what is your church affiliation? And the answer, possible, I forgot to read that. Are you now related to some religious organization? Very active, fairly active, seldom attend, never attend. Now, that doesn't tell us what their church is. We're still not knowing that. But we're getting some picture of their relationship to religion. And then, number nine, do you ever participate in small discussion groups where they talk about many things, including religion, ethics, etc.? And the possibilities are, I have in the past, or I'm in such a group now, or never. And that will give us a picture of this person's relationship to religion or to some kind of group that discusses it. We never do, in this question, ask them what their church affiliation is, because they're not in the hospital, and they're now in a doctor's office. Finally, number 10, do you engage in any form of prayer or meditation? Daily, frequently, occasionally, never. We think that's the most pointed question of all, that it really is focusing on them. Are they taking religion at all seriously through this kind of questionnaire? How do you feel about the last question? Do you engage in any form of prayer or meditation? How would you feel about that? Think the doctor has a right to know that? Daily, frequently, occasionally, never.
Well, my doctor recommended daily meditation as treatment for hypertension.
Okay, the word meditation was put in here carefully, with care, because many doctors who have shied away from prayer are saying, oh, I think I can ask people whether they meditate or not. See, meditation is an okay thing to do now. And the fact that a professor at Harvard, Herbert Benson, has written a book on the importance of meditation and has said in his latest book that the kind of meditation he thinks is the best is very much like prayer. That's about as far as he goes, but at least he's saying that, you know, could be prayer. I'd say for the first time in my lifetime, the scientific world is accepting something very close to what the church has advocated, namely prayer. But call it meditation, and you get by with it much easier than if you call it prayer. Because meditation does not require that you have a belief in a God who hears what you're asking and saying. Now, what I'd like to do is to pass out, I have only 30 copies, I don't know if you'll just share them until we find out how we're doing. To go around? Does everybody have access to read one here? A couple hands back there. Okay. One extra.
Two more.
Two more, that's fine. Now, someone may want to share it with your pastor or something later. Now let me give you the background for this so that you see what it is. This is related to an article on the diagnostic value of religious ideation, which is another way of saying you have to say it fancy in a psychiatric journal. Religious beliefs. Religious ways of looking at life. The man who has his name here is Edgar Draper, but if you saw the article in the journal, you would see that there are four other doctors related to it, three others. Two of the doctors related to this project are atheists, and two are Christians. This man is an ordained Methodist minister, and I met him when he was just starting his medical residency. And he had felt as a pastor that he really wasn't all that good in preaching and that kind of thing, but he did like the counseling side. So he went into medicine and then became a psychiatrist. And later we wrote a book together called Community Psychiatry and the Clergyman. The other doctor is a Christian and was also a pastor before he went into this. But he was going to work with me. He was an LCA pastor. He was going to work with me as a family physician. He turned out to be one of the brightest students they'd ever had. And he had three opportunities to go into three different specialties. And he chose neurosurgery, which is the top specialty of choice for, they're the top man on the totem pole. And he became head of the department of neurosurgery at a famous hospital in Pittsburgh. I was sort of proud of him for that. He had already had 10 years in the parish and four children. And to be able to do all that was great. But I miss him very much because I really wanted him to work closely with me in my projects, and I lost him. I lost two or three others too, by the way, who chose not to go into family medicine. Now, his idea, and the other man whose name is Samuelson, their idea was that as they talked with people who had psychiatric problems, they really were impressed with the number of people in coming into the outpatient clinic of psychiatry who were talking using religious terminology. And as you all know, if you've ever known people in an insane asylum, so-called, mental hospital, often they have religious ideation, religious ways of saying things. And so these two fellows came up with the idea, what if we were to have a first, well, what they decided eventually, let me just tell you how they did it so I don't have to spend too much time on that. They said, let us take a sampling group of patients in the outpatient clinic. Let's say every other patient that comes into the outpatient clinic will be given this test, and the others will not. But it's a random sample. In other words, we're just taking whoever comes in off the street to come into the psychiatry outpatient department. The other patients will just get the typical clinical psychiatric interview. Our patients will get that plus this. Then what we'll do is to summarize this conversation that we had with this patient. And we have it on tape, and then we'll put it together, and then we will give that to one of these other two atheistic psychiatrists, or we'll give it to both of them to read, and to make their diagnosis of this patient's problem on the basis of the religious interview. This will be compared then with the diagnosis that's made by other psychiatrists who have given this same patient the typical psychiatric interview, and we'll see how they come out. They came out within 92% accuracy of each other. That is, the religious content that they were able to offer to the atheistic psychiatrist was so helpful that the psychiatrist could make the diagnosis and come out at the same place that the others did. And then they went on to say that they really felt they knew more about the patient because of the religious interview than they ever would have learned if they had just done a straight psychiatric interview. I think it was really quite an amazing series of questions, and let's just take a look at this. What is your earliest memory of a religious experience or belief? And I'd like all of you to think about this in relation to yourself. Would you tell me, some of you can only hear from a few, of course, in order to get through this. What is your earliest memory of a religious experience or belief. Anybody? Yes?
In a revival meeting, in the United Brethren Church, you have altar calls, and I...
Can you hear?
I answered the altar call, and nothing happened. Absolutely nothing. And I remember very vividly my father coming to me and saying that it was okay, that we would just leave the altar. And that was my first experience.
All right, that's a big one.
That I remember.
That's a big one. About what age?
I don't really know how
Eight?
Old I was. So, probably something like that.
8, 9 years old. Something. All right, what are some other early experiences?
I was in the Methodist Church at the time and went to a summer conference of the Home Mission Board, because they had both boards at that time. And I remember that I was very much influenced by the missionaries who were there, and was convinced that that was the thing I was going to do in my life. I was going to be a missionary.
Uh-huh.
And so that was very early in
very
high
early.
School. And
that,
I did it.
And you did it?
After a bit.
Okay,
many
so
years later.
That influenced you.
I was raised in the Baptist church, and I also had an altar call when I was 9 years of age. It was just like someone took me down the aisle and carried me up front. It was really real.
A great experience,
yes,
that you can't forget. Okay, any others? Yes?
I was deeply moved when my mother took time several evenings to tell the story of Jesus and his suffering in detail. Stands out most visibly.
Now, just picture yourself feeling emotionally disturbed enough to say, I think I really should go to the University of Chicago psychiatric clinic and talk to a psychiatrist about my problems. And imagine how you would feel if he said to you, he didn't just give you these questions like I'm giving them to you, but he said, we'd just like to ask you a few questions, and would you be willing to talk about it to me with the tape recorder going? And to have him say, what is your earliest memory of a religious experience? Now remember, these people came off the street. They weren't religious people in any sense, in the usual sense. And yet, everybody was able to answer that. And they have said, as a result of this experiment, that they were amazed, because the University of Chicago is located in a cosmopolitan neighborhood with people of all types coming in. And most of them are not church people at all. I would say the percentage of church people in that general area would be, you know, maybe around 20% at the most. So 80% were people who were not active church members. And yet everybody who came in was able to deal with these questions, and they were really surprised. And one of the things they said was that maybe religion is more intertwined with our whole culture than we think. Kind of reminds me of being in Sweden one time visiting relatives of mine who were not church people at all. And yet every morning at 7 o'clock, the radio came on. They turned on the radio because the first 5 minutes is a hymn and a prayer and another hymn, I think it was. And finally, after a couple of days of that, I said, you know, I was surprised that you turned that on, because I, you know, you've said you had no interest in religion. Oh, we wouldn't miss that for anything. Wouldn't miss it, right? So it's just a part of the culture, you see. Never step foot inside a church, but you want to start with a prayer and a hymn. Kind of interesting. Second one, what is your favorite Bible story? And then the question, why? Okay, what are some of your favorite Bible stories that you recall or that are still your favorite?
Joseph,
the story of Joseph.
Of course, Jesus, I guess
we could say. Joseph, the father of Jesus, or
no,
Joseph the,
no,
in the Old Testament? Okay, and do you want to take an attempt at why?
Good story.
One of the best.
Well, you know, he's a good model.
He's a good model. And the psychiatrist would probably ask you a little more, to tell a little more, you see. And what the psychiatrist is doing is getting a kind of an idea of what you consider to be a good story and why it's a good story and why it's still with you, and that this helps him to get a picture of who you are. Yes?
I think mine is the story of Abigail and David.
Why?
Well, it deals with a lot of things in life. Abigail was a very bright, intelligent woman who had a nerd for a husband who, and the whole story of that relationship, and then how, because of fear of what David might have done to take him, he has a stroke and dies, and David ends up marrying Abigail. It's a great love story besides. So there are a lot of elements in that particular story.
Okay. And do you see why a psychiatrist could have a field day? It's very important that we hear people's stories and what stories they relate to and what stories they feel comfortable with or what stories we live with. And just kind of think of yourself in relation to the stories of the Bible that you think are very meaningful to you, and know that that tells something about you. 3, what is your favorite Bible verse? Could we have a few of those?
Lift my eyes to the hills from whence cometh my help.
All right, lift my eyes. Why?
It's happened in my life many times, help from God.
Okay, you found real meaning that the uplift is there. And you have called upon him again and again. All right?
Though I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there will thy hand lead me and thy right hand.
There we have again this uplift. All right? What are some other verses that are meaningful? Yes?
God is love.
God is love. Others? Well, just any verses that you like.
While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us.
While we were yet sinners, Christ died.
Even though my heart condemns me, God is greater than my heart and knows all things.
Those two are very similar, you see. Starting with the guilt, and yet we're accepted. You are accepted despite anything, everything.
23rd Psalm.
23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd. I find that to be very helpful at night when I'm not sleeping well. Oh, I go over and over that psalm and stop at each word and see what it means for me. And that's sure a lot better than counting sheep. And then along with that, I try to be filled with gratitude for not being able to sleep. All right. Who is your favorite Bible character and why? Now let's have some. Didn't we have, how did we get that? Oh, you had the story of Joseph. So Joseph would be your favorite character.
One of them.
All right, others with your favorite characters.
Moses.
Moses. Why?
Because of his courage and persistence.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm.
Job.
Why?
Because God does not always bring good things into your life.
Mm-hmm.
We have to deal with it.
Testing is there.
Peter, because he was such a
wimp. Peter, because what?
Such a wimp.
All right, good.
David? His humanity.
All right, his humanity, you betcha.
I like Zacchaeus.
Zacchaeus.
Because of Jesus' acceptance of him. I can really relate to him and his...
You can relate to climbing trees, you like to climb.
No, it's not the climbing trees,
yeah.
But...
Nothing to do with trees.
You're short?
No.
No? All right. But you like his relationship to Jesus.
So. I like Jesus' acceptance of him and his recognition of a person who really wasn't so great in the sight of his fellow man.
Did any of you think of Jesus as a favorite Bible character? I think that is true. 5, what does prayer mean to you? Can you say that in just a sentence or two? What does prayer mean to you?
A fulfillment of feeling of security.
A feeling of security. Other phrases.
Uplifting.
Uplifting.
Guidance.
Guidance.
Lifeline.
Lifeline.
Feeling of hope.
Feeling of hope. Okay. If you pray, what do you pray about? Anybody?
Thanksgiving.
What?
Thanksgiving.
Thanks. Good for you. Thanksgiving. That's fine. All right. What else?
Strength.
Strength.
Guidance.
Guidance.
Gratitude.
Gratitude. You're all helping me feel good. Okay. But see, what you would do if you were let me tell you this, that when they got through with this experiment of 50 people, the question was asked, what if instead of asking religious questions, we had asked questions in the realm of politics, because that's another field that everybody knows something about. Would that have been as effective? Now tell me. What do you think? Or history? Why not?
Maybe the Lord intended it that way.
Maybe the Lord intended it that way.
I think they're not as knowledgeable about the other things, perhaps.
They're not probably as knowledgeable, or are?
Are not.
Are not. That they felt that, let's say that, let's just for the sake of this discussion, say that people would be as, well, first, they were surprised that people were as knowledgeable about religion, that they all had favorite characters, favorite verses even. So that they're probably the knowledgeableness would be about equal, just a small amount of knowledge. Well, don't you think that the difference would be that religion and spiritual things really get at the depths of a human's heart, whereas politics is, and history really doesn't deal with the greatest emotions of the human being? That's what these atheist psychiatrists finally were willing to admit. They said, we got at the heart of these people much faster than we'd ever get in any other way, even through psychiatric questioning. Because these people were telling us about things that were really at the core of their being. And it was a really great experience for them. I knew these two atheist psychiatrists, and they were quite open to saying, maybe this is the way we ought to really get to know people.
It would have been interesting to have them answer those questions.
Yes, it would. I wouldn't have had the courage. All right.
Granger, yes. Do you think it's that a person has more difficult talking about his religion than he would talking about politics?
Which would mean that he's not dealing with anything, that he's dealing with something not as important as religion. Religion is so terribly important, we have difficulty talking about it.
I think we're all guilty of not wanting to share. You know, we don't confess as freely as we could.
Right. Now, if they had done this questionnaire in the Department of Gastrointestinal Diseases, do you think they would have been as successful as they would in the Department of Psychiatry?
You bet.
Yes? No?
Oh, yes.
Yes, why?
It hurts.
It hurts down here in the stomach. Okay? We don't know. I don't know the answer to that, whether they would have been as successful. Their comment was that one of the reasons it was effective in psychiatry is that psychiatric patients are brighter than the other patients. That it takes a good mind to have psychiatric problems. I think there's something to that. In other words, a person with psychiatric difficulties is a person who does a lot of thinking. In fact, one of the questions that we often start with patients coming into psychiatry is, have you been doing a lot of thinking lately? Oh, boy, doctor, have I? Who? That's where it starts, because they've been thinking too much, you see. But you talk to a person in the gastrointestinal, even about his stomach, and say, "I've been doing a lot of thinking lately." Oh, hell no, I've been just doing a lot of business stuff. I've been so busy and full of stress and so on. But the psychiatric patient is the more philosophical type. This was their feeling about it. So, what does religion mean to you? I won't stop at all of these because we don't have enough time, and I want to read a couple things to you. How does God function in your personal life? You know, these are pretty pointed questions to have for just a run-of-the-mill average person coming in. 7, with our health planning conferences, we thought we could do it in about 20 minutes. We can't. We need at least 40 minutes, 45 minutes. And then they just want to continue to talk and talk and talk. So even though we say it's difficult for people to express themselves religiously, once you give them specific questions, particularly ask them, "Was God meaningful to your parents?" "Oh, let me tell you about my mother." And pretty soon they're off and running. But what they're doing when they tell you about their mother is they're giving you a story of their mother from their perspective. And that's why it's important for us to listen to it, because they're saying she was too religious, or she wasn't religious enough. And that's what you're listening for, is how they interpret their mother. If you were talking to this person's sister or brother and asked them the same question, you would get a slightly different interpretation of their mother, though they're talking about the same person. 8, what religious idea or concept is more important to you now? That's kind of a difficult one. I'm never sure. Do you have any thoughts on that one? What religious concept is more important to you now than any other? Could it be the forgiveness concept, maybe?
The guidance.
The guidance concept. The fact that I'm going through hell. Well, here was a lady, for instance, whose favorite Bible character was Mary Magdalene. Why do you think that was her favorite Bible character?
She must have identified with her.
She identified with her. And what would be the identification there?
Promiscuousness.
Promiscuity. And what's the rest of the story about Mary Magdalene?
Forgiveness.
She was accepted. It was just a perfect, easily a way that you could interpret that almost immediately. She could identify with Mary Magdalene because of Christ's willingness to forgive. And could she be forgiven? She sure hoped so, and she hoped that this person asking the question might be accepting of her. 9, what is the most religious act that one can perform? What would you guess that would be? Or, well, I mean, there is no answer. None of these has a specific answer. What would be some answers?
Prayer, sacrifice of self.
The sacrifice of oneself, giving oneself, one's life for one's friend, as the scriptures say. What other things would be religious?
Giving for
the poor and needy. All right. This would tell you something about the person, certainly. What else?
Participation in the Eucharist.
Participation in the Eucharist. That one feels this sense of oneness with God. Well, I think that one had all kinds of things in it. 10, what do you consider the greatest sin that one could commit? What do you think would be some of the answers there?
Could be child abuse.
What? Child abuse? All right, child abuse. That question probably wouldn't have come up 20 years ago because it wasn't that prominent. But today, we think about it all the time because it's
could
so...
Could be divorce.
Divorce?
Taking a life.
Murder? Taking a life?
To make decisions that adversely affect a life in general.
Someone else. Okay.
Or taking your own life, suicide.
Taking your own life. But you can see that the person could go on and on in the discussion on any of these questions. 11, what do you think of evil in the world? My land, what a big question. And I think I'll just pass over that one fast. 12, what are your ideas of an afterlife? And that one has to do with all kinds of fantasies and so on. And then finally, the last one, which was one of the best questions. If God could grant you any three wishes, what would they be? Boy, that's a big one. And the way this person would come at that question would tell you an awful lot about that person. I've never had the courage to ask this question, these questions of people in an outer office and say, would you answer? Because it's really, they're so filled with all kinds of dynamite. Yes?
I have trouble with that question because to me it makes God sound like a very God.
Ah. And you would probably say that to this person asking you that question.
Yes.
And how would you go from there? And so I've heard you say that you don't like that question because it makes God seem like a fairy godmother. Does this mean that you would never feel that God could give you any of your three requests? Or are you unwilling to talk about three requests?
Well, there's several different ones. Whatever God does, he does freely, and it's not a result necessarily asking for something specific.
Okay, so we get into quite a discussion with you about your concept of the nature of God, which would be worthwhile, a worthwhile discussion.
Have you ever used this in a local congregation?
No, but I'd like you all to try it sometime.
That's what I was going to ask. I just see a lot of these questions having a high value for a small group of questions today. And I wonder if it's so power laden that one ought not to just lay those questions out.
What do you all think about that?
Well, these are not unlike questions used in values clarification approaches.
All right.
I view some of these have not quite exactly that way, but we've used them for all of us in a variety of ways.
And that hasn't been harmful.
No. Sharing groups, caring groups, you get to know each other, and then that could lead to other possibilities, open up some possibilities in other settings.
All right. So this may be good for
a person's honesty to those questions would differ according to the size of the group.
All right.
One of the advantages of doing it is a clinical kind of situation where the person they're not in contact with the pastor or whatever it is,
that's
the
right.
Person often can be much more honest in really sharing
This is the article that I've xeroxed from the journal, and if I can very quickly in the last 2 minutes just read a couple lines from it, if I can find the right things. Of perhaps more interest was the finding that the religious data not only enlivened the psychodynamic formulation, but also offered keys to the understanding of certain patients' current conflicts that were not easily grasped from the available psychiatric clinical data. This is what they agreed happened. A number of the patients who might be called unpsychologically minded, whose communications in the psychiatric interviews were stilted and guarded, talked with eager interest, with eagerness, and enlivened affect of their philosophical or religious views. And this is a cross-section of people. Religious affiliations in our sample ranged from Buddhist to atheist, but most were Roman Catholic, Jewish, or Protestant, with a sizable percentage of patients unaffiliated with any religious group. Universally, they had had exposure to formal religions of one variety or another just by living in our culture, TV, for instance. All of them reported some conflictual life experiences in which they integrated or rejected religious precepts. They were not unusually knowledgeable of religious history or literature, but distortions of these were diagnostically useful. For example, a highly exhibitionistic woman, her favorite Bible story was the first book of the Bible, Revelation. For some patients, religion offered distinctly an external trapping for the operations of the superego. For others, it offered ideation and activity used clearly in the service of the ego or its defenses. And they go into this. What we do consider significant is that a patient's religious and philosophical views present as useful an avenue for psychiatric diagnosis as any other personal facet of their lives. The rich resource that religious material offers dynamically qualifies it as another royal road to the unconscious. I think this is a fascinating study, and I wish it could be developed further, and I've tried to get him to do something. He's head of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Mississippi now. Yes.
Two things struck me, I think, with the first spiritual diagnosis in our history, something like this, too. I think, first of all, it would cause people to begin to think, just in terms of themselves totally. But I think the second thing, a person coming into that setting might finally be glad to hear that faith does have something to do with healing, something maybe that they had suspected all along. It wasn't just medicine prescriptions and doctors that most people have experienced some kind of healing other than that, but have been afraid maybe to say anything because the doctor just said, well, here's a pill, go ahead and take that. And so I think to continue that, because it would be helpful to those people to maybe start to talk about how their faith has had something to do with that.
Thank you all.
Thank you.